Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. I'm Michael Grosvenor.
And I'm Jack Frenino. Join us as we dig deep into Billy Joel's songs and history and what his music has meant to us.
Entertainer, and I know just where I stand. Another serenader and another long-haired band. Today I am your champion. I may have won your hearts, but I know the game, you forget my name, and I won't be here in another year if I don't stay on the charts.
The beauty of live music is that a song never sounds the same twice. Billy Joel is no exception to this rule. And with some songs in his catalog nearly 50 years old by now, many of his older numbers have seen drastic changes over the years.
In the first installment of our Evolution of a Song series, we tracked how Say Goodbye to Hollywood and Everybody Loves You Now changed from their first appearances to their most recent.
This time we're reaching far back into the catalog with The Entertainer. This was an early concert staple that got shelved for years before becoming a standard again over the last decade.
What's also notable about this song is that the version on the Streetlife Serenade album couldn't be replicated live. It features more and more instruments, from synthesizers to banjos, layering onto the recording with every verse.
This episode starts with a bare-bones live document that predates the official recording. Then we'll track the song through numerous lineup changes and shows at bigger and bigger venues. Finally, we'll finish with a performance from 2023.
Join us as we dig deep into the evolution of The Entertainer.
This is called The Entertainer.
Let's see, The Entertainer, I was watching, okay, this is 75, I'm watching, it was a television show called Rock Concert with, what was the name of the guy? Don Kirshner. Don Kirshner's Rock Concert. This guy had a voice from the deli, you know?
Billy Joel started out in the playing in the piano bar.
He did, you know, get a lot of musicians started, but he just wasn't the right guy to announce this thing. The other weird show was the Midnight Special. Where would Wolfman Jack? Television, I always thought, kind of trivialized music, especially pop music and rock and roll. TV, they put Elvis Presley on stage with a dog because he sang Hound Dog. TV, I had a lot of resentment against TV, the way they treated rock and roll. And I would watch these shows. They had the same stage, this Art Deco, dopey-looking stage, and you had to use their stage, or else you were
introduced by this guy who, you know, used to work in the garment industry, and he had a TV show.
And I thought this was like assembly line pop. I don't want to be like those bands. I want to present myself my own way, but it was a form of promotion, and you went ahead and did it because that's the way the music business worked. So I started writing these sarcastic lyrics. Now, you got to remember, the only other recording people knew of me before then was Piano Man. It was about a guy kvetching about, oh, I'm in this piano bar and it's a bunch of losers. Man, what are you doing here? La-da-da. You know, kind of a sad song. And now, okay, He's getting some attention, and now he's kvetching about getting the attention. So, you know, I would always do something like that. You know, I would shoot myself in the foot a lot. But I was a young smartass.
We got an amazing response to our first evolution of a song, which was almost a little worrying because we weren't sure if we'd be able to actually follow it up. And we wondered how many songs would actually work with this treatment.
Yeah, it's kind of tricky because you have situations where either a song really doesn't change much throughout its lifespan here. And then you also have songs that really don't have a big enough sample size to draw from. You know, finding that is a little tricky. You know, for example, if you look into 1994 and say River of Dreams, well, River of Dreams in 1994 isn't all that different than River of Dreams in 2024. We're drawing from material from often the first 10 years, things that have come in and out of the set list at the very least.
With the exception of Everybody Loves You Now last time, what's driven these choices has been usually songs that relied a good deal on the studio in some way or another. You know, the first time around, Say Goodbye to Hollywood was a very conscious attempt to fill Spector's wall of sound. So that's not something you're going to have live. So there had to be some thought as to how to fill that out in concert. This time around, The Entertainer has a lot of random instruments, a ton of layering. You may not notice at first how many layers of instruments there are in there, but it just adds another couple tracks, like every verse. And it blends so well that you don't realize until you try to play it or something. You're like, oh man, oh yeah, we're missing the tuba, the banjo, and somehow the Moog synthesizer. Yes, there's a synthesizer going on like down in the bottom of that thing somewhere too.
That's what's fun about this is kind of lining these up in order. You don't necessarily initially notice the changes, but when you can listen to the evolution back to back to back, it really does highlight how things subtly morph over the years. And then when you pick the endpoints, you really do see what the difference is between the two.
If we've never directly said it, we've certainly talked around it. Billy Joel isn't known for changing his live show a lot. He comes out, he pretty much sticks to his beats. You know, he's not like, as we've said so many times, Springsteen or Pearl Jam or, you know, even the Grateful Dead or the Allman Brothers. There's no extended jamming. There aren't the vast reworkings of songs. He hasn't changed the set list, you know, from night to night. Doing something like this, even for me, made me appreciate the wealth of live tracks there are out there now, which were mostly bootleg for a long time. But, you know, over the past few years, the official releases have been slowly catching up. They never will, of course, but we've gotten a good abundance of them come out since the pandemic.
Billy is certainly not an artist like the Dead and the Pearl Jams and the Springsteens of the world where they're going to release everything they've ever recorded. That's just never going to happen. But I'm grateful that they're starting to see the magic and the worthiness in some of these other performances to strategically get some more out there for us. And it's really been a treat to kind of dive into some of this material. Aside from the brand new song, you know, none of us ever thought we'd be getting new Billy Joel music. The prospect of more possible live shows being on the table has been exciting.
When we talked to John Jackson, the Billy Joel's archivist, he stresses that his job is not only to catalog everything and find all these spare clips, but he's putting together a narrative. He's finding the story to tell. I think that's one thing that they're really doing well with these very judicial releases, telling the story. Obviously not in order. It's not like they're purposely starting with, you know, the earliest recording and going forward. But they really are choosing moments that are significant plot points.
I remember when Yankee Stadium was first announced in 2022, it seemed like it almost came out of left field. But again, like you said, the significance of that concert almost outweighs the concert itself. The same thing with the Russia shows. You know, we all know that Billy was having the voice trouble and, you know, it was the end of the tour. This was the last hurrah of the band. There was a lot going on surrounding it that just happened to be documented because the moments surrounding the performance almost were the story as opposed to the performance. But it all ties together.
All right. So with that in mind, let's get started. So the conceit here is pretty simple, and I think we've beaten the horse dead on it, is basically we've chosen two songs, and we've listened to multiple live versions of each through the years. We had to choose songs that were released fairly early in his career and had plenty of official and unofficial live releases to choose from. And we want to see how the arrangements and the performance has changed over time, how the song grew into its own, how it changed, how it needed to change. And, you know, along with that idea of like, you know, what's the story? What do these songs sound like going from small clubs to theaters to arenas to stadiums? Mm-hmm. A smaller band, the Lords, and then a band where I think one of the big changes was once Dave LeBolt came in and Billy didn't have to play the Moog anymore, didn't have to play the synthesizer. How that changed things.
That was a big shift in the band that not a lot of people actually talk about. When Richie left in 1981, adding Mark Rivera and Dave LeBolt, and more so LeBolt, really changed the show. Not only did it free up Billy in those moments where he would play the Moog, but it also allowed LeBolt to further expand upon the keyboard parts and dig a little deeper to what was on the records and really try to fill out the sound a little more. Prior with Richie, he was such a utility player. If you see some old footage there, I mean, he is often just popping back and forth between the organ, the saxophone, the flute, you know, the CP80, he's all over the place in his little area there.
Yeah.
When you have somebody dedicated now to keyboards, that changes the game.
The latest and greatest in synthesizers, even in the 80s, for better or worse, you go from different instrumentation padding out the parts, most often the organ, which I greatly enjoy, to, you know, recreating sounds that were on the record or close to it.
I think this might be a good time to get into our first song. What would you say?
No, let's bullshit a little more and make my life harder 2 days from now.
So the first one we're going to go into today is The Entertainer, which was released in 1974 on Street Life Serenade. And we've got about 9 live versions that range between early 1974 all the way to June of 2023. The first one we're going to start with here predates the album. So it's really interesting to see Billy still essentially working out the song as we go before the album's even released and recorded.
This version is like you can't have your cake and eat it too. It's so spare that I really enjoy it. You know, I mentioned, you know, towards the end of our interview with Zach Alford, I've been on a slight kick about just really nice streamlined music lately. A little less Dixieland, a little less prog, a little less fusion-y kind of stuff. And so this version is really satisfying to me. You wonder if it could have ever like stood the test of time if they hadn't added more accoutrement to it.
Without the treatment that ended up making the record, it almost feels like it could kind of fit in with some of those pre-Piano Man demos. You know, the Long, Long Times of the World and Josephine and all those tracks that, you know, you heard on like MMR but never made it to a record.
Yeah, so the big difference is obviously many parts at the beginning of the song are stretched out. And I would venture to say, you know, a lot of it is just you hadn't cut the fat yet. You're kind of just enjoying this little thing you came up with. You were jamming it out. It's got a lot more rhythm. It's got a lot more riff to it, this version. It's, you know, it's a groove you can really hang on a little longer. It hadn't reached that Billy Tin Pan Alley kind of treatment where every note's going to count.
This show is dated May 10th, 1974. So this was recorded at Ebbets Field in Denver, Colorado. So you're looking at, but between May and October, it's about 5 months before the album came out. So I'm very curious as to where this was in the process. My guess is this is before the record was recorded, because I'm guessing Billy didn't have a big budget to be in the studio very long. So I'm guessing the record was tracked probably by the end of the summer, early fall even. You know, I'm wondering if this was one of those songs that they were workshopping on the road and trying to figure out, or if he had the final version in place in his head, but being such a layered animal that it became, there was no way of replicating that live. And he's not traveling with the Mini Moog at this point. It's a completely different arrangement.
One time when I was playing with a band, we were playing pretty regularly, and
We went into the studio over a weekend to essentially track most of the songs. Basically everything but the vocals and, like, you know, lead guitar stuff was done live. And the producer really reworked the songs. You know, I think there was a couple shows between the recording and the release. We were a little bit in an uncanny valley of how are we playing these songs right now? Because we haven't heard the final version. We don't know what all these guitar overdubs are going to sound like. We were playing a lead up to something we had already recorded.
So then you kind of have to go back and essentially learn the album version and figure out how do we replicate now what we've done in the studio on the stage.
Ron Tutt was able to play around with the beat so much, just being Ron Tutt, you know, and, you know, no slight on, I'm assuming, Reese Clark here. Obviously, you know, you're dealing with a prototype of a song. So there's less dancing around rhythmically with the drums. He kind of nails it and sticks to it the whole time, which certainly works. This is like the Whole Lot of Love version of the song. Just one riff over and over again. Ding, 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 you know. And that guitar, did you notice how much, like, variation there was in the rhythm of that guitar?
Yeah.
Especially at the beginning, like, he's just changing it up a lot. And it doesn't sound to me like his wrist was getting tired or anything. It's like he was to quote a famous fake producer, really exploring the room. You know,
yeah, you know, when you're the only thing in that shot sticking to the same strumming pattern because you're on the same G chord, you know, for 30 seconds in this case, you know, just accenting it a little differently as you go and doing maybe some alternate picking, that can give it a whole different flavor. I really enjoy hearing this without the Moog and without all the layers because it's almost its true songwriting statement. And, you know, one thing that caught my eye throughout the song was the gaps. Also between the verses and the breaks, instead of going right in after the main riff to the vocal, there's a turnaround one time through the phrase before he jumps in. So that kind of extends the sections a little bit. On this earliest version that we have, that extra verse is here in full effect. He would swap out for one of the other verses time to time in the all the way up until maybe 78. But here, I believe every verse is intact. I almost wonder if this was a Billy throwaway line or if this was like once they were in the studio, producers like, yeah, this one's a little campy.
Yeah, it's a little more juvenile than the rest of the song. The whole song is cutting and sarcastic, but it's a little bit of potty humor, which, you know, is fine. But like it does stick out like that, much like a pimple on one's nose would. I think in his vocal delivery, he is the entertainer in this one. He's singing in like really early full Billy voice on this. You know, he's really full-throated on it. He's singing with a slight sense of where, like, I think he is being the entertainer in his unwitting prime. By the time he records the album, he's full-on sarcastic. Like, he's no longer on stage with it. You know, he's no longer like some vaudeville character prancing about. He's now being the jester, so to speak.
Through most of the live versions, and obviously the studio version, 1E and a 2E and a 3E and a 4E and a, subdividing it. He starts the I am the entertainer on the of four going into the beat. 1, 2, 3, 4, I am the entertainer, like that. Throughout here, much of the time, he's starting it on the E of the beat. So instead of I am the entertainer, it's 1, 2, 3, 4, I am the entertainer. And that gives it a different lift to it.
Completely unsyncopated. That was the studio's, it's all on the upbeat. But once he does that, right? He's not hanging out in the 16ths anymore. You know, da-dum-da-dum-da-dum-dum. That's like peacock and head kind of funky a little when you think about it.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. It's like the super triple going around.
Yeah, so that certainly makes that, the verses feel completely different with just changing where he's placing that first note. And as we get to the ending, it's almost as though the band just slowly fades away, leaving Billy on himself playing that little ending riff that does ultimately make the record. It's like the end of the show and he's left by himself once again. You know, that's the story of the entertainer, right? Yeah.
Very vaudeville sounding to me. Obviously, this is, you know, inspired by the movie The Sting, which featured the Scott Joplin's ragtime, the classic, The Entertainer. That really just sounds like a 1920s set piece right there.
Kind of, where's the orchestra? Even though that was a much less grandiose arrangement, it's the small ending.
Right.
Everything fades, and this is like, I'm here now by myself with my thoughts. At the end, I'm by myself.
Yeah, same with Street Life Serenade.
Yeah.
I'd love to know how much of this was thought of originally, or if they really just recorded the bed track and went back later and overdubbed the hell out of it, which is a common way of doing
things. It's very possible that they did that. The bass track was there, and somebody had the idea of like, oh, you know what would be cool? Why don't we try this? That happens all the time in the studio.
So as we're talking about the studio version, Michael and I took a quick break and listened to it. What a masterclass from drummer Ron Tutt this was. Like, this was a thing in country music at this point where you were getting this very unique, syncopated sort of funk going on that was like sort of like country was almost approaching disco with like this four on the floor thing in the 70s, but it was still had like a backbeat to it. Tangled Up in Blue by Bob Dylan. It had a lot of that kind of free drumming to it as well. But it only works when you don't lose the pocket, no matter how displaced and syncopated you're getting. And so now I'm wondering to what extent the bed track was made with the drums being the variation in mind, where everything else was going to be steady, and they let Ron Tutt be Ron Tutt.
I imagine that basic tracks were cut live. With this song, would that be, you know, I'm curious, would it have been the Moog, the bass and the drums, or, you know, the piano bed underneath it? It's clear that Ronnie really drives where this song is going, and so maybe that's what did it, because it's, you know, and I'll go on record, this is one of my favorite recorded Billy Joel drum performances anywhere. It's so on the cusp of being out of control, but it's still just so right in there and so funky, and it grew. One of the things that Ronnie was most known for was Elvis's drummer in the TCB band. And I mean, he would go on to play, do records with Garcia, Grant Parsons, I'm looking at Emmylou Harris, Neil Diamond, just some incredible songwriters. The first record he did with Billy was Piano Man. He played on everything but Captain Jack. I would have loved the opportunity to have picked his brain on this song, because it's most other drummers, it would come off overplaying. But with him, it just sits just right.
It's not quite narrative, but there is a very, very much an element of storytelling in there where just as the song is like this streamlined thing and Billy's being very subversive and agitative throughout, that's sort of what the drums do. Like it's hitting and then it just starts effing you up, but it doesn't eff you up completely. It's like a person that just falls short of insulting you and then you blow your lid. And the guy's like, hey, man, what are you getting mad about? And you're like, you know what you did. You know what you said. You know what you did. You know?
right.
He's just disrupting that wave, but he's not actually disrupting it because, hey, man, you're still tapping your toe. I don't know what your problem is.
Yeah.
You know, it's unfortunate that we're not going to be able to use this audio. So I highly suggest everybody pause and just listen to Tangled Up in Blue from Blood on the Tracks by Bob Dylan. This is almost jazz in the sense that the drums are following the melody and responding to the melody, but not solo.
Yeah.
It's just weaving that tapestry the same way a good jazz drummer is going to comp under a solo.
You know, another thing that kind of, with this studio recording real quick too, is the guitars, how they were sliding into the notes quite a bit. And it kind of gave the song some elasticity. With the synthesizers, a big use of panning and reverb. And that's what's interesting, too, about tracking with these live recordings coming up, is that based on the musicians that are on stage, you can see them making decisions and choices on how they're going to augment the arrangement and how they're going to cover parts based on, you know, who can play what here. That's what's pretty fun about some of these coming up here.
I think the next two are really revelatory. It's Great American Music Hall, which came out before Turnstiles and just before Richie Russell, Howie Emerson, and Lib joined the band. We already had Doug on bass. And then the next one is Billy Joel Tonight, aka Live from Connecticut. What do they usually call it? Whatever they call it. You know what I'm talking about. We got that one great lead up, which is rare to get a good concert recording of a song like this early before the studio recording. Now we see how they're going to reconcile this pocket orchestra of a track. As Michael said, two distinctly separate groups of musicians, two distinctly separate arrangements. So now, Great American Music Hall, what a great splitting of the baby between the original Whole Lotta Love version, as I'm now going to call it, and the studio version.
we get a lot of that steadiness back. We have the variations back at the beginning on the guitar, and obviously the intro is extended again. I like how Reese is splitting the difference between how he's going to play and what Ron Tutt did. The syncopation, he nods to that displacement, but he doesn't really displace. Like, he'll go like boom, pop, right. Pop. He'll hit two snares, which is still kind of funky, but not nearly as displaced. Now he's starting on brushes, right? It sounds like he's slapping the hell out of some brushes and switching to sticks.
Yeah.
Then you start hearing some Reese-isms coming out, you know, that kind of Keith Moon-ish, Mitch Mitchell-ish, jazz-inspired licks. And that's about when Billy, like, he comes back into the vaudeville where he's just the big grandiose, like, you imagine him in, like, the giant twirly handlebar mustache, like, real portly with his barrel chest and, like, some, like, red fucking cape and whatnot.
This song has some good energy. I enjoy what they're doing with it live here. I noticed, too, that on the bass, there almost seems to be just a touch of fuzz.
Yeah, they're recording hot, for sure. The drums distort a little, which I actually enjoy.
You know, this is back in the day of analog recording, so this was recorded, in theory, to 2-inch tape. And so you could kind of hit the recording head a little hot. So instead of like digital clipping, you would just get a hotter little analog distorted sound, which could be used to great effect.
When we talked to Larry Frank about Nylon Curtain, he said that's one of the things that made A Room of Our Own such a great track, great rock and roll track, was because it was pushing into the red, something you can't do with digital.
You know, as we've discussed with this show, you know, Billy is already starting to test the waters of turnstiles, and this record would be coming around the corner in about 8-9 months time. By the end of 1975, everybody but Doug Stegmeier is out. Billy wants to go in and start the project of the next record with just a rhythm section, so he slips Liberty a tape. Liberty learns the songs and wins the audition, wins the gig. And so now we have Doug and Liberty in. Everyone starts coming into the fold when they're doing the record. You know, Billy's like, oh, we should add some guitars to this. Well, we know guitar players. Enter Howie, enter Russell. Then they went out and sought out Richie and brought him into the fold, kind of replacing the Johnny Almond role here. And, you know, that's one thing we didn't really touch on either. The Streetlight Serenader era was very interesting because Billy was now adding a utility player for the first time to the lineup, who is switching between organ, percussion, and saxophone. He's really now starting to think about thickening the sound and filling out the sound more and more, adding that utility guy who can help fill in those gaps.
Yeah, I think the one thing we didn't mention real quick was that there's congas at the beginning of the Great American Music Hall version.
So now we're going to Billy Joel Tonight, which was that famed first video release, recorded Palmer Auditorium, December 1976. So this is about, you know, about 9 months into the Turnstiles tour. And so now we're getting about 6 months of this band gelling on the road.
You know what the funny thing is about Great American Music Hall and Billy Joel Tonight back to back? Both Reese and Lib cheat, and they have to give the snare cue on those,
I noticed
on
that
those
too.
Hits at the end. For almost anyone else, I would say, oh great, they're streamlining their sound and they're just getting ready to play a stadium or an arena where, you know, you're gonna lose subtlety because you have to, you know, you have to like play less notes because it's gonna reverberate and, you know, everything has to be amplified out. But, you know, in listening to this, and this is a great example of why we're doing this episode, I think with Billy, this really was where he was coming into his own. He was obviously leaving behind that singer-songwriter trope. And he was trying to be like Leonard Bernstein or Cole Porter or someone like that. It's not just that the sound is bigger. It is orchestrated. It does sound almost like a stage production. And what really did make it unique was the fact that these were unwashed dudes from Long Island. You know, so it's still rock and roll. It's still this like lived in uninformed drum rhythms that were just forged from experience rather than, you know, being taught. And it's, you know, whatever Russell was bringing in terms of reggae and his own, you know, unique sense of rhythm guitar playing and things like that stopped it from just being Barry Manilow or something like that with like bassless, you know, pit orchestra kind of music behind it.
Yeah, this was like a band from the streets, you know? I mean, granted, yeah, Long Island, but it's like you just feel New York in it. That's the kind of band that this was. So, you know, these guys weren't trained. These guys were all by gut, and all by feel, what they were hearing. It just gives it an edge and a power that not every trained musician would necessarily bring to the table.
We now hear the difference between what Reese brings out of Ronnie Tutt's drums and what Lib brings out. Reese brought a bit of that syncopation. Lib digs deep into the funk, the choppiness of those 16th notes and the almost ghosting kind of thing. He's way more streamlined through this whole thing. You don't notice it till you watch the video when he does like a lot of cymbal crashes, like right off each other. Psh, psh, yeah. Yeah, that kind of thing. That speaks to it being very orchestrated and not jazzy in the responsive sense. Like, he's not answering Billy's parts by doing fills. He's accenting the parts by adding crashes that really blend into the whole mix. And let's talk for a moment about Howie Emerson, please. You know, that great long lost, undersung, missing link between Billy's California days and his New York albums, because despite being from Long Island as well, Howie was always playing sly, playing like country slicks, and on this one, he's playing a pedal steel.
You know how I talked about on the studio recording how, you know, they're kind of sliding into the chords quite a bit throughout it? The pedal steel really lends itself to that, both in sliding into the note and sliding, you know, sliding up the volume. It really works well with trying to represent some of that feel. Another thing I was keying into a lot as well, too, because as Jack and I are going through this, we're watching some video and some is just audio. This particular performance from Billy Joel tonight, we have the good fortune of video, and I'm keying into the relationship between Billy's right and left hand between the Moog and the piano. You know, you're seeing him work the Moog, not only the keys, but the knobs, and just it's really interesting to see him really working both sides of it.
Just like it's, you know, a bunch of dudes from Long Island playing complex music, there's a charm to Billy having to split the parts like that and think about how to pull this off.
As the technology improved, his need to be very technically proficient on working the gear goes away. All he has to focus on now is playing the parts on the piano. Doesn't have to worry about, you know, changing the timbre on the Moog and doing little adjustments on the fly. He's still playing it in the original key. And since it's all digital, everything's just transposed into the right key. So all of these things, while really interesting to see the technology makes you have to work a little less hard in some areas, I like seeing the younger era where I'm like, oh yeah, Billy really knows his way around the gear here.
Especially with the Moog, you know, to tune a Moog, you just have to do it by ear, and it goes, it could go out of tune odd ways because it's just, you're just manipulating the electrical current. The keys are arbitrary. You can't just hold up a tune or two and call it a day.
And, you know, now with the new technology, everything's in perfect pitch every time because you're having patches and samples that are all preloaded. And so there's no having to dial in and get things in key. And that's why they eliminated the CP80 and the Fender Rhodes and all the ones that rely on other electronics and mechanics. All of that question mark goes out the window now.
Glass half empty, glass half full. Question mark, or you got a unique performance every time?
The response of those instruments changed night to night. You know, that can kind of influence how he plays it. You could get a little bit of a different feel, or he's like, oh, this reminds me of this. I'm gonna kind of go here for a minute because it reminds me of this other song. There's a little more room for play in that way.
I still like Billy Joel tonight more than Carnegie Hall for this song.
I do too.
I feel like they played it a little too straight at Carnegie.
Yeah.
Because it was Carnegie.
A little too
or proper. Like, just a hair.
So one big change with this, even though it's only 6 months after Billy Joel tonight, is Russell has left the tour as he's starting to pursue his own solo career. So now we just have Howie Emerson, Liberty DeVito, Richie Cannata, and Doug Stagmeier, and obviously Billy.
And what's fun about this one is we have at least the third, and we're assuming the fourth guitarist to take on this intro. Michael confirmed that there were 9 guitarists credited on Street Life Serenade, so we don't know which one played the intro on the record. But we know that Don played the pre-album performance, played on Great American Music Hall. Russell was on Billy Joel tonight, and Howie is on Carnegie Hall. Howie's the most brash. You know, he's adding like these deft stops in the middle of it. He's just like kind of cutting notes out and stuff. He's adding what do you think? 16th note triplets or possibly 32nd notes. Double timing, you know, some of his strums here and there. We have the Moog noodling and the vocalizations. And I think we hear Lib's drum part become a little more Lib. I think you, Michael, pointed out a couple.
Yeah, we're starting to see his drum fill personality come out. And I'm starting to hear some elements and some stylistic choices in the fills that you would hear, say, in like an Angry Young Man or something. So we're starting to see some of that come up here, where he's really starting to take those spots and make them his own.
As always, whenever we get to a CW Pose version, it's the outlier. They were just waving them all over the stage. Like, you know, right. It's the hometown show. They've been on the road for so long. They're just really letting loose and screwing around, and the audience is loving it. And, you know, 50 years later, we love it too.
We're starting to get a tambourine on the verses, keeping the 2 and 4. But by Old Grey Whistle Test, which is just a year later, that extra verse disappears. And by all accounts, it's gone for good.
One thing you get on CW Post, and it's subtle, but it's there, is there's a lot more musical conversation going on, which harkens back to the pre-Lords days, to the pre-Billy Joel Tonight Live in Connecticut days, where I was saying that's, you know, it's about where, you know, he really started calling the band the orchestra, and they really started playing more like an orchestra, where they were, you know, leaning into their parts. You know, when Lib does like some choppy fills and stuff here, he's doing them way more often in response to what Billy's saying. And Billy's doing a lot of crazy boogie-woogie piano as he's singing in between, you know, in response to his own lyrics.
Now we're to March 14th, 1978. This is the Old Grey Whistle Test show that aired on TV, and clips from it would air on like VH1 and things like that back in the 90s. And Russell Javers is now back in the band, and his hair's shorter. Notice too, I think there's something with his monitors, because he's signaling to somebody in his ears.
You can tell by the way he's attacking the Moog too. You know, on Billy Joel Tonight, he was really gliding over it, and he's a little more deliberate. And we were listening to on our last watch party on Discord, Capitol Theater, he was actually complaining about being on the Old Grey Whistle
That's
Test.
That's right.
So yeah, and knowing that, you could see him, he's not having it.
And this is his second performance, because that was prior to this.
You see Richie playing the organ. You don't hear it that much, but I guarantee you'd notice if it wasn't there. Like now I'm listening for it and I can hear it.
Yeah.
Real tight stop on Hearts, you know, on that verse where with the stops. Yeah, this version is really, I feel like this is the culmination, and it's telling that this is like the last one we have for
a while,
not on a few decades. Yeah. They really crystallize it here.
Yeah.
Everything's tight. Maybe a hair too tight. Maybe a hair too polished. Call it having done it so many years on the road. Call it trying to play it safe because you're on TV and maybe you're not hearing things as well as you want to. But the upshot of it is all those arrangement adjustments they've been making seem to be in full force now. Fully fleshed out, fully developed, executed pristinely.
They spend these years kind of dialing into this, and then they decide to put it away completely.
It's the time to do it, you know, leave it on a high note, because like now it's starting to almost feel a little stale. And I think Billy said, like, you know, how long am I going to bitch, moan, and complain about not having a hit record
right. When
I have a hit record?
And again, it goes to something as well, too, that we've talked about. Now we're getting into Billy, and every album produces like hit after hit after hit. 52nd Street and then Glass Houses. You know, you've got 3 to 4 huge hits on each record that are pushing 6 songs out of the set. Well, what's going to go? So, you know, suddenly we have to start make some decisions. And at this point as well, Billy is leveling up from the theaters, the colleges, to the Coliseums and the arenas. So how well does the entertainer in 1980 play in an arena, you know? The song disappeared from set lists. And at least according to Setlist FM, between 1980 and 2006, only 17 performances of it in 26 years. So it definitely became a rarity up until the 12 Gardens era, which is coincidentally our next recording. And so we're fast forwarding all the way from 1978 to the spring of 2006 for 12 Gardens Live.
Now we've definitely streamlined the end. So it's 4 beats between and then 2 beats between those breaks at the very end, which is indicative of a lot of what we're hearing here. The days of Ron Touch drums are long gone, whereas Reese Clark and Liberty DeVito streamlined Ron Touch parts. Chuck Berge definitely streamlined Liberty DeVito's parts. I don't think he loses anything, but I don't think he adds anything either. I think he's just there on this one. When we did 12 Gardens Live, we talked a lot about how Chuck's sense of rhythm allowed Billy to bounce around and riff a little more rhythmically off the song, whereas he had to be more locked in with Lib. I think on this one, we don't really get that effect
necessarily. Yeah, you know, the one big change I know too in the drums is a lot of Crashable on the one.
Yeah, which harkens back to Reese a bit, but not in that same like almost right. Monty Python-ish way.
By 2006, as most of you know by now, we have a completely different band, especially from 1978. With the exception, on this 12 Gardens run, Richie Cannata did shows with them. But I struggle to find any place for him. I think he essentially just came up as an additional sax player when needed. So essentially, aside from Richie, the 2006 lineup, you had obviously Billy, and now you've got David Rosenthal on keyboard, Mark Rivera, keyboards, guitars, sax, flute, Tommy Burns on guitar, Crystal Taliaferro, guitar, percussion, and sax, and vocal, Andy Cicione on bass and vocals, Chuck Berge on drums, and Carl Fisher on horns as well. So a much bigger lineup. You know, we were talking about the addition of Dave LaBolt in the 80s, yet we don't have any recordings of him playing this.
I do like the way the synths sound on this, but it is, you know, it's almost a shame to me. You know, obviously by this time it's patched in, it's dialed in meticulously and really, really well. I just like a little more creakiness to it personally.
Yeah, the humanness and the finicky response to the move is gone. It's like you said, it's all so precise and so dialed in that the character, a big part of what made the mini move so special to me, that's all gone now.
And in a similar sense, we have to address the way Billy's singing this. You know, he hung this one up for a while because it just sounded like overly petulant for him to bitch about not having a hit song when he had so many hit songs. When he brings it back, he's not being vaudeville. He's not being sarcastic. He's very reflective in this version. You hear it all the times his voice softens. That has to be a conscious choice. How am I going to do this song in 2006?
He can't deliver lines like this with the same piss and vinegar as a 25-year-old. It's worth noting, too, that the key has dropped significantly as well to accommodate very much deepened voice by this point.
This is one where I think it fits really well. Like, it really fills it out. When you hear, like, Keeping the Faith, you're like, whoa, that is low. But this one, you know, it just allows him to be a little more full. It's even, I mean, he sings this even fuller than he did back at, you know, in the 70s. I would give two sort of companions to listen to outside of Billy for this, you know, in terms of his vocal delivery. One is, first one's a bit of a stretch, which is Girls in Their Summer Clothes by Springsteen off, I think it's on Magic. It's just a song written by an older fella. The girls in their summer clothes pass me by now. Like, you know, he sees them, but you know, this is, he's so far removed from being young. You know, it's noticeable. That in itself is the old man version of Dean Martin standing on the corner watching all the girls go by. The immortal, they ain't going to do this line anymore, brother. You can't go to jail for what you're thinking.
I forgot about that. That plays very differently right now.
And the other one is the Grateful Dead's version of Scarlet Begonias from the 90s that's on the So Many Roads box set. Hearing Jerry sing that as an old man hits so differently. You know, when he first did it, it was in the 70s, and, you know, they were still bebopping all over the place and, you know, I'm sure getting laid like mad. And then when he sings in the 90s, when he's getting old, you can hear his voice already going. When he gets to that line, had to learn the hard way just to let her pass by.
Yeah.
It's got that same reflectiveness that obviously the original didn't have. You know, the original was a psychedelic game of poker. This is like an old man being like, man, I see this girl. She's wild. She's this, she's that. But I'm past that now, you know. And, you know, you listen to those three things, those two, and this version of The Entertainer, I feel like it serves up that aging rocker deal.
Funny enough, by this point now, too, he's also augmenting the line, After a While in a Thousand Miles, now becomes After a While in a Million Miles. This is no longer a guy fighting for his career. This is a guy looking back at all the shit he went through.
That puts the button on this version very nicely. It makes it more reflective. It plays into that.
You know, this song got so well received when it re-entered the set in 2006 that it has stayed almost consistently between now and then. We have our last version here, which, to be honest with you, I don't know how different it's going to be, so I'm kind of curious. This was recorded by our friend Jenny Norderby, who has gone to, it seems like, nearly every residency show in the last, I don't know, 5+ years. And this was recorded June 2nd, 2023 at Madison Square Garden.
So what's fun about this one is that, you know, we're getting to see it on video. We're keying into things. Michael pointed out that, like, on the Moog lines at the beginning, he turns around and mimes the part. And yeah, he does a little like he pitter patters his heart at the one part.
Musically, with the rhythm, it's also a little more streamlined, a little less syncopation, and focusing more on the groove and less of the skippy syncopation that you would hear with, you know, Reese all the way through Liberty. That's a little peeled back more, and it's more of a straight ahead rock and roll groove.
It is, and it's almost disappointing until you get a little about halfway through the song, where I was saying he's more reflective in 06. On this one, and again on video, we get the advantage of seeing the moment where he does this thing where he looks out into the crowd and gives his little smile. And when he comes back, he's got so much more grit in his voice. And that's something that I think he couldn't have done without such a streamlined open beat.
Right.
That he had something just to propel. That he didn't have to like reconcile a lot of shit going on at once.
It really allowed him to get a little guttural there. You know, that's the nice part about the video is you could see what led to that. You could see him like really kind of locking into the crowd and going and getting a little energy out of it and just pushing right into that next verse.
That was from less than a year ago. And for us, that's the end of the story because, you know, that's all we got for now. At least we don't know what's going to happen, but it's a fun way to leave this one because it feels complete. It could have felt complete on 12 Gardens and it would have been maybe just a slight sure. bummer that he was just being reflective, but then to watch him look out in the audience and then hear him turn around and punch it. You know what I mean? It's like, you still got that fire. It is still there. Yeah.
There's still some juice.
Yeah. It really just seemed to bring it out of him at that moment. I hope that's a harbinger of what we see post residency in the wake of a new single, in the anticipation of Will There Be More, for a guy that doesn't have to do it. Yeah, man, that spark is still there.
You mentioned the new single and the through line with all these interviews we'd listened to and read and everything was Freddie helped Billy find the fun. And you could see that moment where I don't want to say he's on autopilot, but he's playing a song he's played a million times for 45 years, hones into a moment in the room that snaps him out of the familiar and takes him to somewhere new. I love that we're still getting that in 2023 and 2024 out of Billy.
So I don't know, man. Here's to the next batch of performances of this song. So for now, do you tune back in? Let us know what you think. Give a whole bunch of versions of The Entertainer a listen and chime in if you could, please. What do you think? What changes jump out to you? Which eras did you like? Which eras did you not like? What kind of narrative did you pick out as the song progressed? GlassHousesPodcast@gmail.com. Find us on the socials, Facebook, X, and Instagram, Glass Houses, a Billy Joel podcast. And if you want to talk to us in real time, Michael, you want to tell them how to do that?
Yeah, we've got a great Discord server that we launched at the end of 2022. Wow, it's hard to believe it's been that long now, year and a half. But we've got a great community of Billy Joel fans and podcast listeners that has been growing as the months have gone by. We have great spirited discussions about Billy's releases, songs, tour dates, you name it. Anything Billy is all on the table. And we also talk about life. We talk about other music we're all into because Billy's the common thread, but we all have a lot of other different musical interests as well. It's just a great spot where we all have really cool conversations. And it's where we do our monthly watch parties, where we all get together in real time on our Discord server and we stream a live concert. We do music videos, interview segments, you name it. Anything Billy related, we all sit down together, watch it, talk about it, and it's a really good time. And it's a good chance for us to connect with you all even further.
Yeah, so come on out, say hello, give us your thoughts. We'll see you next time.
See you soon, everyone. Thanks.